This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Kindred by Octavia E. Butler, narrated by Kim Staunton. This book is copyrighted 1979 by Octavia E. Butler. This recording is copyrighted 1998 by Recorded Books. It begins on June 9th, 1976, her 26th birthday. It will be all over by July 4th, the bicentennial anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. In those few short weeks, Dana Franklin will see years of history pass before her astonished eyes. And now, Kindred.
Prologue. I lost an arm on my last trip home, my left arm. And I lost about a year of my life and much of the comfort and security I had not valued until it was gone. When the police released Kevin, he came to the hospital and stayed with me so that I would know I hadn't lost him too. But before he could come to me, I had to convince the police that he did not belong in jail. That took time. The police were shadows who appeared intermittently at my bedside to ask me questions I had to struggle to understand. "How did you hurt your arm?" they asked. "Who hurt you?" My attention was captured by the word they used, hurt, as though I'd scratched my arm. Didn't they think I knew it was gone? "Accident," I heard myself whisper. "It was an accident." They began asking me about Kevin. Their words seemed to blur together at first, and I paid little attention. After a while, though, I replayed them and suddenly realized that these men were trying to blame Kevin for hurting my arm. "No," I shook my head weakly against the pillow. "Not Kevin. Is he here? Can I see him?" "Who, then?" they persisted. I tried to think through the drugs, through the distant pain, but there was no honest explanation I could give them. None they would believe. "An accident," I repeated. "My fault, not Kevin's. Please let me see him." I said this over and over until the vague police shapes let me alone, until I awoke to find Kevin sitting, dozing beside my bed. I wondered briefly how long he had been there, but it didn't matter. The important thing was that he was there. I slept again, relieved. Finally, I awoke feeling able to talk to him coherently and understand what he said. I was almost comfortable except for the strange throbbing of my arm, of where my arm had been. I moved my head, tried to look at the empty place, the stump. Then Kevin was standing over me, his hands on my face, turning my head toward him. He didn't say anything. After a moment, he sat down again, took my hand, and held it. I felt as though I could have lifted my other hand and touched him. I felt as though I had another hand. I tried again to look, and this time he let me. Somehow I had to see to be able to accept what I knew was so. After a moment, I lay back against the pillow and closed my eyes. "Above the elbow," I said.
"They had to."
"I know. I'm just trying to get used to it." I opened my eyes and looked at him. Then I remembered my earlier visitors. "Have I gotten you into trouble?"
"Me?"
"The police were here. They thought you had done this to me."
"Oh, that. They were sheriff's deputies.
The neighbors called them when you started to scream. They questioned me, detained me for a while. That's what they call it. But you convinced them that they might as well let me go." "Good. I told them it was an accident. My fault." "There's no way a thing like this could be your fault."
"That's debatable. But it certainly wasn't your fault.
Are you still in trouble?"
"I don't think so. They're sure I did it, but there's no witnesses. And you won't cooperate. Also, I don't think they can figure out how I could have hurt you. In the way you were hurt."
I closed my eyes again, remembering the way I had been hurt
remembering the pain.
Are you all right? Kevin asked.
Yes. Tell me what you told the police.
The truth.
He toyed with my hand for a moment silently. I looked at him, found him watching me.
If you told those deputies the truth, I said softly, you'd still be locked up in a mental hospital.
He smiled. I told as much of the truth as I could. I said I was in the bedroom when I heard you scream. I ran to the living room to see what was wrong, and I found you struggling to free your arm from what seemed to be a hole in the wall. I went to help you. That was when I realized your arm wasn't just stuck, but that somehow it had been crushed right into the wall.
Not exactly crushed.
I know, but that seemed to be a good word to use on them, to show my ignorance. It wasn't all that inaccurate either. Then they wanted me to tell them how such a thing could happen. I said I didn't know. Kept telling them I didn't know. And heaven help me, Dana, I don't know.
Neither do I whispered. Neither do I.
The river.
The trouble began long before June 9th, 1976, when I became aware of it. But June 9th is the day I remember. It was my 26th birthday. It was also the day I met Rufus, the day he called me to him for the first time. Kevin and I had not planned to do anything to celebrate my birthday. We were both too tired for that. On the day before, we had moved from our apartment in Los Angeles to a house of our own a few miles away in Altadena. The moving was celebration enough for me. We were still unpacking, or rather I was still unpacking. Kevin had stopped when he got his office in order. Now he was closeted there, either loafing or thinking, because I didn't hear his typewriter. Finally, he came out to the living room where I was sorting books into one of the big bookcases. Fiction only. We had so many books we had to try to keep them in some kind of order.
What's the matter? I asked him.
Nothing. He sat down on the floor near where I was working. Just struggling with my own perversity. You know, I had half a dozen ideas for that Christmas story yesterday during the moving. And none when there's time to write them down. Not a one. He picked up a book, opened it, and turned a few pages. I picked up another book and tapped him on the shoulder with it. When he looked up, surprised, I put a stack of nonfiction down in front of him. He stared at it unhappily. Hell, why'd I come out here?
To get more ideas. After all, they come to you when you're busy.
He gave me a look that I knew wasn't as malevolent as it seemed. He had the kind of pale, almost colorless eyes that made him seem distant and angry, whether he was or not. He used them to intimidate people. Strangers. I grinned at him and went back to work. After a moment, he took the nonfiction to another bookcase and began shelving it. I bent to push him another box full, then straightened quickly as I began to feel dizzy, nauseated. The room seemed to blur and darken around me. I stayed on my feet for a moment, holding on to a bookcase and wondering what was wrong. Then finally, I collapsed to my knees. I heard Kevin make a wordless sound of surprise, heard him ask, "What happened?" I raised my head and discovered that I could not focus on him. "Something is wrong with me," I gasped. I heard him move toward me, saw a blur of gray pants and blue shirt. Then, just before he would have touched me, he vanished. The house, the books, everything vanished. Suddenly I was outdoors, kneeling on the ground beneath trees. I was in a green place. I was at the edge of a woods. Before me was a wide, tranquil river, and near the middle of the river was a child splashing, screaming, drowning. I reacted to the child in trouble. Later I could ask questions, try to find out where I was, what had happened.
Now I went to help the child. I ran down to the river, waded into the water fully clothed, and swam quickly to the child. He was unconscious by the time I reached him, a small red-haired boy floating, face down. I turned him over, got a good hold on him so that his head was above water, and towed him in. There was a red-haired woman waiting for us on the shore now, or rather, she was running back and forth, crying on the shore. The moment she saw that I was waiting, she ran out, took the boy from me, and carried him the rest of the way, feeling and examining him as she did. "He's not breathing," she screamed. Artificial respiration. I had seen it done, been told about it, but I had never done it. Now was the time to try. The woman was in no condition to do anything useful, and there was no one else in sight. As we reached shore, I snatched the child from her. He was no more than 4 or 5 years old, and not very big. I put him down on his back, tilted his head back, and began mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. I saw his chest move as I breathed into him. Then suddenly, the woman began beating me. "You killed my baby," she screamed. "You killed him!" I turned and managed to catch her pounding fists. "Stop it," I shouted, putting all the authority I could into my voice. "He's alive." Was he? I couldn't tell. Please, God, let him be alive. "The boy's alive. Now let me help him." I pushed her away, glad she was a little smaller than I was, and turned my attention back to her son. Between breaths, I saw her staring at me blankly. Then she dropped to her knees beside me, crying. Moments later, the boy began breathing on his own, breathing and coughing and choking and throwing up and crying for his mother. If he could do all that, he was all right. I sat back from him, feeling lightheaded, relieved. I had done it. "He's alive!" cried the woman. She grabbed him and nearly smothered him. "Oh, Rufus, baby!" Rufus, ugly name to inflict on a reasonably nice-looking little kid. When Rufus saw that it was his mother who held him, he clung to her, screaming as loudly as he could. There was nothing wrong with his voice, anyway. Then suddenly there was another voice. "What the devil's going on here?" A man's voice, angry and demanding. I turned, startled, and found myself looking down the barrel of the longest rifle I had ever seen. I heard a metallic click, and I froze, thinking I was going to be shot for saving the boy's life. I was going to die. I tried to speak, but my voice was suddenly gone. I felt sick and dizzy. My vision blurred so badly I could not distinguish the gun or the face of the man behind it. I heard the woman speak sharply, but I was too far gone into sickness and panic to understand what she said. Then the man, the woman, the boy, the gun all vanished. I was kneeling in the living room of my own house again, several feet from where I had fallen minutes before. I was back at home, wet and muddy, but intact. Across the room, Kevin stood frozen, staring at the spot where I had been. How long had he been there? "Kevin?" He spun around to face me. "What the hell? How did you get over there?" he whispered. "I don't know." "Dana, you..." He came over to me, touched me tentatively as though he wasn't sure I was real. Then he grabbed me by the shoulders and held me tightly. "What happened?" I reached up to loosen his grip, but he wouldn't let go. He dropped to his knees beside me. "Tell me," he demanded. "I would if I knew what to tell you. Stop hurting me." He let me go finally, stared at me as though he just recognized me. "Are you all right?" "No." I lowered my head and closed my eyes for a moment. I was shaking with fear, with residual terror that took all the strength out of me. I folded forward, hugging myself, trying to be still. The threat was gone, but it was all I could do to keep my teeth from chattering. Kevin got up and went away for a moment. He came back with a large towel and wrapped it around my shoulders. It comforted me somehow, and I pulled it tighter. There was an ache in my back and shoulders where Rufus's mother had pounded with her fists. She had hit harder than I realized, and Kevin hadn't helped. We sat there together on the floor, me wrapped in the towel and Kevin with his arm around me, calming me just by being there. After a while, I stopped shaking. "Tell me now," said Kevin. "What?" "Everything. What happened to you? How did you move like that?" I sat mute, trying to gather my thoughts, seeing the rifle again leveled at my head. I had never in my life panicked that way, never felt so close to death. "Dana," he spoke softly. The sound of his voice seemed to put distance between me and the memory. "But still..." "I don't know what to tell you," I said. "It's all crazy." "Tell me how you got wet," he said. "Start with that." I nodded. "There was a river," I said. "Woods with a river running through. And there was a boy drowning. I saved him. That's how I got wet." I hesitated, trying to think to make sense. Not that what had happened to me made sense, but at least I could tell it coherently. I looked at Kevin, saw that he held his expression carefully, neutral. He waited. More composed, I went back to the beginning, to the first dizziness, and remembered it all for him, relived it all in detail. I even recalled things that I hadn't realized I'd noticed. The trees I'd been near, for instance, were pine trees, tall and straight with branches and needles mostly at the top. I had noticed that much somehow in the instant before I had seen Rufus. And I remembered something extra about Rufus's mother. Her clothing. She had worn a long, dark dress that covered her from neck to feet. A silly thing to be wearing on a muddy riverbank. And she had spoken with an accent. A southern accent. Then there was the unforgettable gun, long and deadly. Kevin listened without interrupting. When I was finished, he took the edge of the towel and wiped a little of the mud from my leg. "This stuff had to come from somewhere," he said. "You don't believe me?" He stared at the mud for a moment, then faced me. "You know how long you were gone?" "A few minutes, not long." "A few seconds. There were no more than 10 or 15 seconds between the time you went and the time you called my name." "Oh, no." I shook my head slowly. "All that couldn't have happened in just seconds." He said nothing. "But it was real. I was there." I caught myself, took a deep breath, and slowed down. "All right. If you told me a story like this, I probably wouldn't believe it either. But like you said, this mud came from somewhere."
"Yes."
"Look, what did you see? What do you think happened?" He frowned a little, shook his head.
"You vanished."
He seemed to have to force the words out.
"You were here until my hand was just a couple of inches from you. Then suddenly you were gone. I couldn't believe it. I just stood there. Then you were back again and on the other side of the room."
"Do you believe it yet?" He shrugged.
"It happened. I saw it. You vanished and you reappeared. Facts."
"I reappeared wet, muddy, and scared to death."
"Yes. And I know what I saw and what I did. My facts. They're no crazier than yours."
"I don't know what to think."
"I'm not sure it matters what we think."
What do you mean?
Well, it happened once. What if it happens again?
No, no, I don't think you don't know.
I was starting to shake again.
Whatever it was, I've had enough of it. It almost killed me.
Take it easy, he said. Whatever happens, it's not going to do you any good to panic yourself again.
I moved uncomfortably, looked around. I feel like it could happen again, like it could happen any time. I don't feel secure here.
You're just scaring yourself.
No.
I turned to glare at him, and he looked so worried, I turned away again. I wondered bitterly whether he was worried about my vanishing again or worried about my sanity. I still didn't think he believed my story.
Maybe you're right, I said. I hope you are. Maybe I'm just like a victim of robbery or rape or something, a victim who survives but who doesn't feel safe anymore.
I shrugged. I don't have a name for this thing that happened to me, but I don't feel safe anymore.
He made his voice very gentle. If it happens again, and if it's real, the boy's father will know he owes you thanks. He won't hurt you.
You don't know that. You don't know what could happen.
I stood up unsteadily. Hell, I don't blame you for humoring me.
I paused to give him a chance to deny it, but he didn't.
I'm beginning to feel as though I'm humoring myself.
What do you mean?
I don't know. As real as the whole episode was, as real as I know it was, it's beginning to recede from me somehow. It's becoming like something I saw on television or read about, like something I got secondhand.
Or like a dream?
I looked down at him. You mean a hallucination?
All right.
No! I know what I'm doing. I can see. I'm pulling away from it because it scares me so. But it was real.
Let yourself pull away from it.
He got up and took the muddy towel from me.
That sounds like the best thing you can do, whether it was real or not. Let go of it.
The fire. 1. I tried. I showered, washed away the mud and the brackish water, put on clean clothes, combed my hair.
That's a lot better, said Kevin when he saw me.
But it wasn't.
Rufus and his parents had still not quite settled back and become the dream Kevin wanted them to be. They stayed with me, shadowy and threatening. They made their own limbo and held me in it. I had been afraid that the dizziness might come back while I was in the shower, afraid that I would fall and crack my skull against the tile, or that I would go back to that river, wherever it was, and find myself standing naked among strangers. Or would I appear somewhere else, naked and totally vulnerable?
I washed very quickly. Then I went back to the books in the living room, but Kevin had almost finished shelving them.
Forget about any more unpacking today, he told me. Let's go and get something to eat.
Go?
Yes, where would you like to eat? Someplace nice for your birthday.
Here.
But here, really, I don't want to go anywhere.
Why not?
I took a deep breath.
Tomorrow, I said. Let's go tomorrow.
Somehow tomorrow would be better. I would have a night's sleep between me and whatever had happened. And if nothing else happened, I would be able to relax a little.
It would be good for you to get out of here for a while, he said.
No.
Listen, no!
Nothing was going to get me out of the house that night if I could help it.
Kevin looked at me for a moment. I probably looked as scared as I was. Then he went to the phone and called out for chicken and shrimp. But staying home did no good. When the food had arrived, when we were eating and I was calmer, the kitchen began to blur around me. Again the light seemed to dim and I felt the sick dizziness.
I pushed back from the table but didn't try to get up. I couldn't have gotten up.
Dana?
I didn't answer.
Is it happening again?
I think so. I sat very still, trying not to fall off my chair. The floor seemed farther away than it should have. I reached out for the table to steady myself, but before I could touch it, it was gone. And the distant floor seemed to darken and change. The linoleum tile became wood, partially carpeted. And the chair beneath me vanished. 2. When my dizziness cleared away, I found myself sitting on a small bed sheltered by a kind of abbreviated dark green canopy. Beside me was a little wooden stand containing a battered old pocket knife, several marbles, and a lighted candle in a metal holder. Before me was a red-haired boy.
Rufus?
The boy had his back to me and hadn't noticed me yet. He held a stick of wood in one hand, and the end of the stick was charred and smoking. Its fire had apparently been transferred to the draperies at the window. Now the boy stood watching as the flames ate their way up the heavy cloth. For a moment I watched too. Then I woke up, pushed the boy aside, caught the unburned upper part of the draperies and pulled them down. As they fell, they smothered some of the flames within themselves, and they exposed a half-open window. I picked them up quickly and threw them out the window. The boy looked at me, then ran to the window and looked out. I looked out too, hoping I hadn't thrown the burning cloth onto a porch roof or too near a wall. There was a fireplace in the room. I saw it now, too late. I could have safely thrown the draperies into it and let them burn. It was dark outside. The sun had not set at home when I was snatched away, but here it was dark. I could see the draperies a story below, burning, lighting the night only enough for us to see that they were on the ground and some distance from the nearest wall. My hasty act had done no harm. I could go home knowing that I had averted trouble for the second time. I waited to go home. My first trip had ended as soon as the boy was safe, had ended just in time to keep me safe. Now, though, as I waited, I realized that I wasn't going to be that lucky again. I didn't feel dizzy. The room remained unblurred, undeniably real. I looked around, not knowing what to do. The fear that had followed me from home flared now. What would happen to me if I didn't go back automatically this time? What if I was stranded here, wherever here was? I had no money, no idea how to get home. I stared out into the darkness, fighting to calm myself. It was not calming, though, that there were no city lights out there. No lights at all. But still, I was in no immediate danger, and wherever I was, there was a child with me, and a child might answer my questions more readily than an adult. I looked at him. He looked back, curious and unafraid. He was not Rufus. I could see that now. He had the same red hair and slight build, but he was taller, clearly 3 or 4 years older. Old enough, I thought, to know better than to play with fire. If he hadn't set fire to his draperies, I might still be at home. I stepped over to him, took the stick from his hand, and threw it into the fireplace. "Someone should use one like that on you," I said, "before you burn the house down." I regretted the words the moment they came out. I needed this boy's help. But still, who knew what trouble he had gotten me into? The boy stumbled back from me, alarmed. "You lay a hand on me and I'll tell my daddy." His accent was unmistakably Southern, and before I could shut out the thought, I began wondering whether I might be somewhere in the South, somewhere 2 or 3,000 miles from home. If I was in the South, the 2 or 3 hour time difference would explain the darkness outside. But wherever I was, the last thing I wanted to do was meet this boy's father. The man could have me jailed for breaking into his house, or he could shoot me for breaking in. There was something specific for me to worry about. No doubt the boy could tell me about other things. And he would. If I was going to be stranded here, I had to find out all I could while I could. As dangerous as it could be for me to stay where I was, in the house of a man who might shoot me, it seemed even more dangerous for me to go wandering into the night totally ignorant. The boy and I would keep our voices down, and we would talk. "Don't you worry about your father," I told him softly. "You'll have plenty to say to him when he sees those burned draperies." The boy seemed to deflate. His shoulders sagged, and he turned to stare into the fireplace. "Who are you, anyway?" he asked. "What are you doing here?" So he didn't know either. Not that I had really expected him to. But he did seem surprisingly at ease with me, much calmer than I would have been at his age about the sudden appearance of a stranger in my bedroom. I wouldn't even have still been in the bedroom. If he had been as timid a child as I was, he would probably have gotten me killed. "What's your name?" I asked him. "Rufus." For a moment, I just stared at him. "Rufus?" "Yeah. What's the matter?" I wished I knew what was the matter. What was going on? "I'm all right," I said. "Look, Rufus, look at me. Have you ever seen me before?" "No." That was the right answer, the reasonable answer. I tried to make myself accepted in spite of his name, his too familiar face. But the child I had pulled from the river could so easily have grown into this child in 3 or 4 years. "Can you remember a time when you nearly drowned?" I asked, feeling foolish. He frowned, looked at me more carefully. "You were younger," I said. "About 5 years old, maybe? Do you remember?" "The river?" The words came out low and tentative, as though he didn't quite believe them himself. "You do remember, then. It was you." "Drowning. I remember that. And you..." "I'm not sure you ever got a look at me, and I guess it must have been a long time ago for you." "No, I remember you now. I saw you." I said nothing. I didn't quite believe him. I wondered whether he was just telling me what he thought I wanted to hear, though there was no reason for him to lie. He was clearly not afraid of me. "That's why it seemed like I knew you," he said. "I couldn't remember, maybe because of the way I saw you. I told Mama, and she said I couldn't have really seen you that way."
"What way?"
"Well, with my eyes closed."
"With your..."
I stopped. The boy wasn't lying. He was dreaming. "It's true," he insisted loudly. Then he caught himself, whispered. "That's the way I saw you just as I stepped in the hole."
"Hole?"
"In the river. I was walking in the water, and there was a hole. I fell, and then I couldn't find the bottom anymore. I saw you inside a room. I could see part of the room, and there were books all around, more than in Daddy's library. You were wearing pants, like a man, the way you are now. I thought you were a man."
"Thanks a lot.
But this time you just look like a woman wearing pants." I sighed.
"All right, never mind that. As long as you recognize me as the one who pulled you out of the river."
"Did you? I thought you must have been the one."
I stopped, confused. "I thought you remembered."
"I remember seeing you. It was like I stopped drowning for a while and saw you and then started to drown again. After that, Mama was there. And Daddy."
"And Daddy's gone," I said bitterly.
Your father almost shot me. He thought you were a man, too, and that you were trying to hurt Mama and me. Mama says she was telling him not to shoot you, and then you were gone.
Yes.
I had probably vanished before the woman's eyes. What had she thought of that?
I asked her where you went, said Rufus, and she got mad and said she didn't know. I asked her again later, and she hit me, and she never hits me.
I waited, expecting him to ask me the same question, but he said no more. Only his eyes questioned. I hunted through my own thoughts for a way to answer him. Where do you think I went, Ruth? He sighed, said disappointedly,
You're not going to tell me either.
Yes, I am, as best I can. But answer me first. Tell me where you think I went. He seemed to have to decide whether to do that or not.
Back to the room, he said finally. The room with the books?
Is that a guess, or did you see me again?
I didn't see you. Am I right? Did you go back there?
Yes. Back home to scare my husband, almost as much as I must have scared your parents.
But how did you get there? How did you get here?
Like that. I snapped my fingers.
That's no answer.
It's the only answer I've got. I was at home, then suddenly I was here helping you. I don't know how it happens, how I move that way or when it's going to happen. I can't control it.
Who can?
I don't know. No one. I didn't want him to get the idea that he could control it, especially if it turned out that he really could.
But what's it like? What did Mama see that she won't tell me about?
Probably the same thing my husband saw. He said when I came to you, I vanished, just disappeared. He thought about that.
Disappeared? You mean like smoke?
Fear crept into his expression.
Like a ghost?
Like smoke, maybe. But don't go getting the idea that I'm a ghost. There are no ghosts.
That's what Daddy says.
He's right. But Mama says she saw one once. I managed to hold back my opinion of that. His mother, after all. Besides, I was probably her ghost. She had had to find some explanation for my vanishing. I wondered how her more realistic husband had explained it. But that wasn't important. What I cared about now was keeping the boy calm. You needed help, I told him. I came to help you. Twice. Does that make me someone to be afraid of?
I guess not.
He gave me a long look, then came over to me, reached out hesitantly, and touched me with a sooty hand. You see, I said, I'm as real as you are. He nodded.
I thought you were.
All the things you did, you had to be. And Mama said she touched you too. She sure did. I rubbed my shoulder where the woman had bruised it with her desperate blows. For a moment, the soreness confused me, forced me to recall that for me the woman's attack had come only hours ago. Yet the boy was years older. Fact then, somehow my travels crossed time as well as distance. Another fact, the boy was the focus of my travels, perhaps the cause of them. He had seen me in my living room before I was drawn to him. He couldn't have made that up. I had seen nothing at all, felt nothing but sickness and disorientation. Mama said what you did after you got me out of the water was like the second book of Kings, said the boy.
The what?
Where Elisha breathed into the dead boy's mouth and the boy came back to life. Mama said she tried to stop you when she saw you doing that to me because you were just some nigger she had never seen before. Then she remembered 2 Kings. I sat down on the bed and looked over at him, but I could read nothing other than interest and remembered excitement in his eyes.
She said I was what?
I asked.
Just a strange nigger. She and Daddy both knew they hadn't seen you before.
That was a hell of a thing for her to say right after she saw me save her son's life.
Rufus frowned.
Why?
I stared at him. What's wrong? He asked. Why are you mad?
Your mother always calls black people niggers, Ruth?
Sure, except when she has company.
Why not? His air of innocent questioning confused me. Either he really didn't know what he was saying, or he had a career waiting in Hollywood. Whichever it was, he wasn't going to go on saying it to me.
I'm a black woman, Ruth. If you have to call me something other than my name, that's it.
But, look, I helped you. I put the fire out, didn't I?
Yeah.
All right, then. You do me the courtesy of calling me what I want to be called.
He just stared at me.
Now, I spoke more gently. Tell me, did you see me again when the draperies started to burn? I mean, did you see me the way you did when you were drowning?
It took him a moment to shift gears. Then he said, I didn't see anything but fire.
He sat down on the old ladder-back chair near the fireplace and looked at me.
I didn't see you until you got here. But I was so scared. It was kind of like when I was drowning, but not like anything else I can remember. I thought the house would burn down and it would be my fault. I thought I would die.
I nodded. You probably wouldn't have died because you would have been able to get out in time. But if your parents are asleep here, the fire might have reached them before they woke up.
The boy stared into the fireplace. I burned the stable once, he said. I wanted Daddy to give me Nero, a horse I liked. But he sold him to Reverend Wyndham just because Reverend Wyndham offered a lot of money. Daddy already has a lot of money. Anyway, I got mad and burned down the stable.
I shook my head wonderingly. The boy already knew more about revenge than I did. What kind of man was he going to grow up into?
Why did you set this fire?
I asked. To get even with your father for something else?
For hitting me. See?
He turned and pulled up his shirt so that I could see the crisscross of long red welts. And I could see old marks, ugly scars of at least one much worse beating.
For God's sake!
He said I took money from his desk, and I said I didn't. Rufus shrugged. He said I was calling him a liar, and he hit me.
Several times.
All I took was a dollar. He put his shirt down and faced me. I didn't know what to say to that. The boy would be lucky to stay out of prison when he grew up. If he grew up. He went on.
I started thinking that if I burned the house, he would lose all his money. He ought to lose it. It's all he ever thinks about.
Rufus shuddered.
But then I remembered the stable and the whip he hit me with after I set that fire. Mama said if she hadn't stopped him, he would have killed me. I was afraid this time he would kill me, so I wanted to put the fire out. But I couldn't. I didn't know what to do.
So he had called me. I was certain now. The boy drew me to him somehow when he got himself into more trouble than he could handle. How he did it, I didn't know. He apparently didn't even know how he was doing it. If he had, and if he had been able to call me voluntarily, I might have found myself standing between father and son during one of Rufus's beatings. What would have happened then, I couldn't imagine. One meeting with Rufus's father had been enough for me. Not that the boy sounded like that much of a bargain, either.
But did you say he used a whip on you, Ruf?
Yeah, the kind he whips niggers and horses with. That stopped me for a moment. The kind he whips who?
He looked at me warily. I wasn't talking about you.
I brushed that aside. Say blacks, anyway. But your father whips black people?
When they need it.
But Mama said it was cruel and disgraceful for him to hit me like that no matter what I did. She took me to Baltimore City to Aunt May's house after that, but he came and got me and brought me home. After a while, she came home too. For a moment, I forgot about the whip and the niggers. Baltimore City. Baltimore, Maryland? Are we far from Baltimore now, Ruth?
Across the bay.
But we're still in Maryland, aren't we?
I have relatives in Maryland, people who would help me if I needed them, and if I could reach them. I was beginning to wonder, though, whether I would be able to reach anyone I knew. I had a new, slowly growing fear.
Sure we're in Maryland, said Rufus. How could you not know that?
What's the date?
I don't know.
The year. Just tell me the year.
He glanced across the room toward the door, then quickly back at me. I realized I was making him nervous with my ignorance and my sudden intensity. I forced myself to speak calmly. Come on, Ruth. You know what year it is, don't you?
It's 1815.
When?
1815.
I sat still, breathed deeply, calming myself, believing him. I did believe him. I wasn't even as surprised as I should have been. I had already accepted the fact that I had moved through time. Now I knew I was farther from home than I had ever thought. And now I knew why Rufus's father used his whip on niggers as well as horses. I looked up and saw the boy had left his chair and come closer to me.
What's the matter with you?
He demanded.
You keep acting sick.
It's nothing, Ruth. I'm all right. No, I was sick. What was I going to do? Why hadn't I gone home? This could turn out to be such a deadly place for me if I had to stay in it much longer. Is this a plantation? I asked.
The Whalen Plantation. My dad is Tom Whalen.
Whalen. The name triggered a memory, something I hadn't thought of for years. Rufus, do you spell your last name W-E-Y-L-I-N?
Yeah, I think that's right.
I frowned at him impatiently. A boy his age should certainly be sure of the spelling of his own name, even a name like this with an unusual spelling.
It's right, he said quickly.
And is there a black girl, maybe a slave girl, named Alice living around here somewhere? I wasn't sure of the girl's last name. The memory was coming back to me in fragments.
Sure. Alice is my friend.
Is she? I was staring at my hands, trying to think. Every time I got used to one impossibility, I ran into another.
She's no slave either, said Rufus.
She's free.
Born free like a mother.
Oh, then maybe somehow... I let my voice trail away as my thoughts raced ahead of it, fitting things together. The state was right, and the time, the unusual name, the girl Alice.
Maybe what? Prompted Rufus.
Yes, maybe what?
Well, maybe... If I wasn't completely out of my mind, if I wasn't in the middle of the most perfect hallucination I'd ever heard of,
if the child before me was real and was telling the truth, maybe he was one of my ancestors. Maybe he was my several times great-grandfather, but still vaguely alive in the memory of my family because his daughter had bought a large Bible in an ornately carved wooden chest and had begun keeping family records in it. My uncle still had it. Grandmother Hager. Hager Whalen. Born in 1831. Hers was the first name listed. And she had given her parents' names as Rufus Whalen and Alice Green something Whalen. Rufus, what's Alice's last name?
Greenwood. What were you talking about? Maybe what?
Nothing. I just thought I might know someone in her family.
Do you?
I don't know. It's been a long time since I've seen the person I'm thinking of.
Weak lies. But they were better than the truth.
As young as the boy was, I thought he would question my sanity if I told the truth.
Alice Greenwood. How would she marry this boy? Or would it be marriage? And why hadn't someone in my family mentioned that Rufus Wayland was white?
If they knew. Probably they didn't.
Hager Wayland Blake had died in 1880, long before the time of any member of my family that I had known. No doubt most information about her life had died with her. At least it had died before it filtered down to me. There was only the Bible left.
Hager had filled pages of it with her careful script. There was a record of her marriage to Oliver Blake, and a list of 7 children, their marriages, some grandchildren. Then someone else had taken up the listing. So many relatives that I had never known, would never know. Or would I? I looked over at the boy who would be Hager's father. There was nothing in him that reminded me of any of my relatives. Looking at him confused me. But he had to be the one. There had to be some kind of reason for the link he and I seemed to have. Not that I really thought a blood relationship could explain the way I had twice been drawn to him. It wouldn't. But then neither would anything else. What we had was something new. Something that didn't even have a name. Some matching strangeness in us that may or may not have come from our being related. Still, now I had a special reason for being glad I had been able to save him. After all, what would have happened to me, to my mother's family, if I hadn't saved him? Was that why I was here? Not only to ensure the survival of one accident-prone small boy, but to ensure my family's survival, my own birth. Again, what would have happened if the boy had drowned? Would he have drowned without me? Or would his mother have saved him somehow? Would his father have arrived in time to save him? It must be that one of them would have saved him somehow. His life could not depend on the actions of his unconceived descendant. No matter what I did, he would have to survive to Father Hager, or I could not exist. That made sense. But somehow it didn't make enough sense to give me any comfort. It didn't make enough sense for me to test it by ignoring him if I found him in trouble again. Not that I could have ignored any child in trouble. But this child needed special care. If I was to live, if others were to live, he must live. I didn't dare test the paradox.
"You know," he said, peering at me, "you look a little like Alice's mother. If you wore a dress and tied your hair up, you'd look a lot like her."
He sat down companionably beside me on the bed. "I'm surprised your mother didn't mistake me for her then," I said.
"Not with you dressed like that. She thought you were a man at first, just like I did, and like Daddy did."
"Oh." That mistake was a little easier to understand now.
"Are you sure you aren't related to Alice yourself?"
"Not that I know of," I lied. And I changed the subject abruptly. "Ruth, are there slaves here?" He nodded.
38 slaves, Daddy said.
He drew his bare feet up and sat cross-legged on the bed facing me, still examining me with interest.
"You're not a slave, are you?"
"No."
"I didn't think so. You don't talk right or dress right or act right. You don't even seem like a runaway."
"I'm not."
"And you don't call me master either."
I surprised myself by laughing.
"Master? You're supposed to."
He was very serious.
"You want me to call you black?"
His seriousness stopped my laughter. What was funny, anyway? He was probably right. No doubt I was supposed to give him some title of respect.
But master?
You have to say it, he insisted. Or young master, or mister, like Alice does. You're supposed to.
No, I shook my head. Not unless things get a lot worse than they are now. The boy gripped my arm.
Yes, he whispered. You'll get into trouble if you don't, if Daddy hears you.
I'd get into trouble if Daddy heard me say anything at all. But the boy was obviously concerned, even frightened for me. His father sounded like a man who worked at inspiring fear. All right, I said. If anyone else comes, I'll call you Mr. Rufus. Will that do? If anyone else came, I'd be lucky to survive.
Yes, said Rufus.
He looked relieved.
I still have scars on my back where Daddy hit me with a whip.
I saw them. It was time for me to get out of this house. I had done enough talking and learning and hoping to be transported home. It was clear that whatever power had used me to protect Rufus had not provided for my own protection. I had to get out of this house and to a place of safety before day came. If there was a place of safety for me here. I wondered how Alice's parents managed, how they survived.
Hey! Said Rufus suddenly.
I jumped, looked at him, and realized that he had been saying something, something I had missed.
I say it, what's your name? He repeated. You never told me.
Was that all? Edana, I said. Most people call me Dana.
Oh, no, he said softly.
He stared at me the way he had when he thought I might be a ghost.
What's wrong?
Nothing, I guess. But, well, you wanted to know if I had seen you this time before you got here the way I did at the river?
Well, I didn't see you, but I think I heard you.
How? When?
I don't know how. You weren't here. But when the fire started and I got so scared, I heard a voice. A man. He said, Dana? Then he said, is it happening again? And someone else, you, whispered, I think so. I heard you.
I sighed wearily, longing for my own bed and an end to questions that had no answers. How had Rufus heard Kevin and me across time and space? I didn't know. I didn't even have time to care. I had other, more immediate problems.
Who was the man? Rufus asked.
My husband. I rubbed a hand across my face. Ruf, I have to get out of here before your father wakes up. Will you show me the way downstairs so that I don't awaken anyone?
Where will you go?
I don't know, but I can't stay here. I paused for a moment, wondering how much he could help me, how much he would help me. I'm a long way from home, I said, and I don't know when I'll be able to get back there. Do you know of any place I could go? Rufus uncrossed his legs and scratched his head.
You could go outside and hide until morning. Then you could come out and ask Daddy if you could work here. He hires free niggers sometimes.
Does he? If you were free and black, do you think you'd want to work for him? He looked away from me, shook his head.
I guess not. He's pretty mean sometimes.
Is there someplace else I could go? He did some more thinking.
You could go to town and find work there.
What's the name of the town?
Easton.
Is it far?
Not so far. The niggers walk there sometimes when Daddy gives them a pass. Or maybe...
What?
Alice's mother lives closer. You could go to her, and she could tell you the best places to go get work. You could stay with her, too, maybe. Then I might see you again before you go home.
I was surprised he wanted to see me again.
I hadn't had much contact with children since I'd been one myself. Somehow I found myself liking this one, though. His environment had left its unlikable marks on him, but in the antebellum South, I could have found myself at the mercy of someone much worse. Could have been descended from someone much worse. "Where can I find Alice's mother?" I asked. "She lives in the woods. Come on outside, and I'll tell you how to get there." He took his candle and went to the door of his room. The room's shadows moved eerily as he moved. I realized suddenly how easy it would be for him to betray me, to open the door and run away or shout an alarm. Instead, he opened the door a crack and looked out. Then he turned and beckoned to me. He seemed excited and pleased and only frightened enough to make him cautious. I relaxed, followed him quickly. He was enjoying himself, having an adventure. And, incidentally, he was playing with fire again, helping an intruder to escape undetected from his father's house. His father would probably take the whip to both of us if he knew. Downstairs, the large heavy door opened and we stepped into the darkness outside. The near darkness. There was a half moon and several million stars lighting the night as they never did at home. Rufus immediately began to give me directions to his friend's house, but I stopped him. There was something else to be done first. "Where would the draperies have fallen, Ruf? Take me to them." He obeyed, taking me around a corner of the house to the side. There, what was left of the draperies lay smoking on the ground. "If we can get rid of this," I said, "can you get your mother to give you new draperies without telling your father?" "I think so," he said. "They hardly talk to each other anyway." Most of the remnants of the drapes were cold. I stamped out the few that were still edged in red and threatening to flame up again. Then I found a fairly large piece of unburned cloth. I spread it out flat and filled it with smaller pieces and bits of ash and whatever dirt I scooped up along with them. Rufus helped me silently. When we were finished, I rolled the cloth into a tight bundle and gave it to him. "Put it in your fireplace," I told him. "Watch to see it all burns before you go to sleep. But, Ruf, don't burn anything else." He glanced downward, embarrassed. "I won't." "Good. There must be safer ways of annoying your father. Now, which way is it to Alice's house?" 3. He pointed the way, then left me alone in the silent, chilly night. I stood beside the house for a moment, feeling frightened and lonely. I hadn't realized how comforting the boy's presence had been. Finally, I began walking across the wide, grassy land that separated the house from the fields. I could see scattered trees and shadowy buildings around me. There was a row of small buildings off to one side, almost out of sight of the house. Slave cabins, I supposed. I thought I saw someone moving around one of them, and for a moment, I froze behind a huge spreading tree. The figure vanished silently between two cabins, some slave probably as eager as I was to avoid being caught out at night. I skirted around a field of some grassy, waist-high crop I didn't even try to identify in the dim light. Rufus had told me his shortcut, and that there was another longer way by road. I was glad to avoid the road, though. The possibility of meeting a white adult here frightened me more than the possibility of street violence ever had at home. Finally, there was a stand of woods that looked like a solid wall of darkness after the moonlit fields. I stood before it for several seconds, wondering whether the road wouldn't be a better idea after all. Then I heard dogs barking, not too far away by their sound, and in sudden fear, I plunged through a tangle of new young growth and into the trees. I wondered about thorns, poison ivy, snakes. I wondered, but I didn't stop. A pack of half-wild dogs seemed worse, or perhaps a pack of tame hunting dogs used to track runaway slaves. The woods were not as totally dark as they had seemed. I could see a little after my eyes grew accustomed to the dimness. I could see trees, tall and shadowy, trees everywhere. As I walked on, I began to wonder how I could be sure I was still going in the right direction. That was enough. I turned around hoping that I still knew what around meant and headed back toward the field. I was too much of a city woman. I got back to the field all right, then veered left to where Rufus had said there was a road. I found the road and followed it, listening for the dogs. But now only a few night birds and insects broke the silence. Crickets, an owl, some other bird I had no name for. I hugged the side of the road, trying to suppress my nervousness, and praying to go home. Something dashed across the road so close to me that it almost brushed my leg. I froze, too terrified even to scream, then realized that it was just some small animal that I had frightened. A fox, perhaps, or a rabbit. I found myself swaying a little, swaying dizzily. I collapsed to my knees, desperately willing the dizziness to intensify, the transferal to come. I had closed my eyes. When I opened them, the dirt path and the trees were still there. I got up wearily and began walking again. When I had been walking for a while, I began to wonder whether I had passed the cabin without seeing it, and I began to hear noises, not birds or animals this time, not anything I could identify at first, but whatever it was, it seemed to be coming closer. It took me a ridiculously long time to realize that it was the sound of horses moving slowly down the road toward me. Just in time, I dove into the bushes. I lay still, listening. Shaking a little, wondering whether the approaching horsemen had seen me. I could see them now, dark, slowly moving shapes going in a direction that would eventually take them past me on toward the Whalen house. And if they saw me, they might take me along with them as their prisoner. Blacks here were assumed to be slaves unless they could prove they were free, unless they had their free papers. Paperless blacks were fair game for any white. And these riders were white. I could see that in the moonlight as they came near. Then they turned and headed into the woods just a few feet from me. I watched and waited, keeping absolutely still until they had all gone past. 8 white men out for a leisurely ride in the middle of the night. 8 white men in the area where the Greenwood cabin was supposed to be. After a moment of indecision, I got up and followed them, moving carefully from tree to tree. I was both afraid of them and glad of their human presence. Dangerous as they could be to me, somehow they did not seem as threatening as the dark, shadowy woods with its strange sounds, its unknowns. As I had expected, the men led me to a small log cabin in a moonlit clearing in the woods. Rufus had told me I could reach the Greenwood cabin by way of the road, but he hadn't told me the cabin sat back out of sight of the road. Maybe it didn't. Maybe this was someone else's cabin. I half hoped it was, because if the people inside this cabin were black, they were almost certainly in for trouble. 4 of the riders dismounted and went to hit and kick the door. When no one answered their pounding, 2 of them began trying to break it down. It looked like a heavy door, one more likely to break the men's shoulders than it was to give. But apparently the latch used to keep the door shut wasn't heavy. There was a sound of splintering wood, and the door swung inward. The 4 men rushed in with it, and a moment later, 3 people were shoved, almost thrown out of the cabin. 2 of them, a man and woman, were caught by the riders outside who had dismounted, apparently expecting them. The 3rd, a little girl dressed in something long and light-colored, was allowed to fall to the ground and scramble away, ignored by the men. She moved to within a few yards of where I lay in the bushes near the edge of the clearing. There was talk in the clearing now,
and I began to distinguish words over the distance and through the unfamiliar accents.
"No pass," said one of the riders. "He sneaked off."
"No, master," pleaded one of those from the cabin, clearly a black man speaking to whites. "I had a pass. I had..."
One of the whites hit him in the face. Two others held him, and he sagged between them. More talk.
"If you had a pass, where is it?"
"Don't know. I must have dropped it coming here."
They hustled the man to a tree so close to me that I lay flat on the ground, stiff with fear. With just a little bad luck, one of the whites would spot me, or, in the darkness, fail to spot me and step on me. The man was forced to hug the tree, and his hands were tied to prevent him from letting go. The man was naked, apparently dragged from bed. I looked at the woman who still stood back beside the cabin and saw that she had managed to wrap herself in something. A blanket, perhaps. As I noticed it, one of the whites tore it from her. She said something in a voice so soft that all I caught was her tone of protest.
"Shut your mouth," said the man who had taken her blanket.
He threw it on the ground.
"Who the hell do you think you are, anyway?"
One of the other men joined in.
"What do you think you got that we haven't seen before?"
There was raucous laughter.
"Seen more and better,"
someone else added. There were obscenities, more laughter. By now, the man had been securely tied to the tree. One of the whites went to his horse to get what proved to be a whip. He cracked it once in the air, apparently for his own amusement, then brought it down across the back of the black man. The man's body convulsed, but the only sound he made was a gasp. He took several more blows with no outcry, but I could hear his breathing hard and quick. Behind him, his child wept noisily against her mother's leg, but the woman, like her husband, was silent. She clutched the child to her and stood, head down, refusing to watch the beating. Then the man's resolve broke. He began to moan low, gut-wrenching sounds torn from him against his will. Finally, he began to scream. I could literally smell his sweat, hear every ragged breath, every cry, every cut of the whip.